The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for August 12th, 2017. So the show this week, we have two great conversations. First up is Brendan Leonard. You might remember a few weeks ago, I spoke with Outside Magazine's executive editor, Axie Navis, about the two newest additions to the online masthead, Eben Weiss, a.k.a. Bike Snob NYC, and Brendan Leonard, who writes the wildly popular blog site SemiRad. Brendan does a lot more than just his blog and now his weekly column in Outside Online. I chat with him about his life, his work, and his goals. Then, while it doesn't happen often, I'm happy to have an in-studio guest. Rob Myers, who is a personal friend, has a cycling story to tell that I think will fascinate anyone who follows the news. Besides being a strong and competent cyclist, Rob is also a student of history, geology, and current events. He rode the FIDF 2015 ride in Israel and came away with a new perspective on the country, the people, and what it's like to live, work, and ride in the Middle East. So off to Colorado to speak with Brendan Leonard about SemiRad. Hi, Brendan. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, it is my pleasure, Mr. Man of Adventure. You are a life of adventure and you report on it. Let's begin at the beginning. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? And then what?
Boy, I grew up in a bunch of small towns around Iowa, actually, and then went to college. I left Iowa for grad school. Long story short, after substance abuse treatment, went to rehab after college, and then moved to Missoula, Montana, to get a master's degree in journalism. And that's kind of where I started getting into the mountains more as an adult. And I think I was taking a magazine writing class, and we had to talk about what magazines we thought we'd like to write for, what we'd like to write about. At that time, it was almost the end of grad school. I said, oh, I'm going to write about music, you know, and then we had to get published in a magazine to actually pass the class. The grad students did. So I ended up writing a really quick article for Idaho Magazine about a little hiking trip I'd taken. And that was kind of the start of everything for me. Like, oh, okay, I guess I can just do adventure writing. And it was a lot easier for me to get started in that than it was music journalism, I guess, because I could do things on the weekends or, you know, in my free time that I was going to do anyway, because I really liked being outside and then write about them. So that's how that worked.
Wow, that's pretty interesting, actually. How long ago was that? So when did you get finished with grad school, write that article, and then start moving on?
That was 2004.
Oh, so you're just a young whippersnapper. I got it. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel young.
Yeah, you are. You got...
Every day, yeah.
Lots in front of you. So your website, which is semirad.com, talks about the every person, man or woman, and how you like to crush it, sort of. What does that mean?
I started the website in 2011. I guess what I was at the time, it seemed like everybody was concentrating on like kind of high end athletes and outdoors and what they could do. And while that's inspirational, you know, on one level, I just thought, you know, we should talk about all the rest of us who are out, the 99.9% of us who are out there just having fun doing these things and pushing ourselves in our own ways. And, you know, people with real jobs that we only have weekends or whatever to do these things. And we're not ever going to climb really hard or win mountain bike races or anything like that, but we still love it. So I kind of just always focused on that as far as adventure goes. It really worked out as a brand for me, I guess I would say.
Well, humor seems to be a huge part of your writing and your lifestyle and what sort of gets you excited. So what do you find amusing?
Oh, I mean, I think it's fun to kind of make fun of ourselves, you know, like what I like to do, I guess, with most of the stuff I write is I'm not like making fun of someone else. I'm making fun of us, all the people who do these ridiculous things, like, you know, go walk around in the mountains with a 50 pound backpack on for a week, you know, and all these things that we do for enlightenment or whatever we're doing them for. So that's always fun for me. I've always observed people, you know, like how we interact and the things we do and, you know, watch people at airports and in other public places. And humans are just an endless source of fascination, you know.
And humor.
Yeah. And I mean, humor comes way easier than introspection. People, I feel like, you know, I try to do a few things like that, like maybe twice a month, but to constantly be doing things that are like making people think, people don't generally want that all the time. You know, it gets pretty heavy. So if you give people something light, and like my blog comes out every Thursday for 6 years, you know, and I think a lot of times people just want a laugh at that point in the week. And, you know, especially with all the news that we read nowadays, it's like, oh gosh, you know, you can feel like the world's coming to an end. So I feel like being the bright spot in somebody's week is a lot better, a lot easier. It will draw more bees to the honey, you know, as opposed to trying to give people kind of heavy introspective stuff every week. So the humor has been, that's the easiest thing for me. I've been trying to be funny since I was like 4 years old. So
you probably have succeeded once or twice.
I hope so. Yeah.
Well, you have a great list of humorous, what you call your most humorous posts on your blog. It includes titles like 9 Reasons Why You Should Never Bike to Work, Hey Girl Memes for Outdoorsy Women, The Rules for Dating a Dirtbag, Pooping in the Outdoors, a Flowchart. Why don't you take a couple of those and tell us how you came up with them? Let's start with 9 Reasons Why You Should Never Bike to Work, since we talk about biking to work a lot on this show.
You know, that thing gets picked up every couple of years, that story, and goes around the internet again. And whenever I can see it, I watch it. I watch people's reactions to it. And mostly it's this kind of satirical thing for cyclists. Be like, they recognize that, you know, people who do bike to work or bike other places and, you know, in their city or their town, you know, as a form of transportation, they recognize all the excuses that are in that list. Cause that's what they are to me. You know, it's like, oh, I could never do that, blah, blah, blah. You know, I've done both sides of this equation, like trying to encourage people to do things and also kind of making fun of the reasons we don't want to do things. And both times you do that, someone always pops up on the internet and is like, yeah, but I couldn't do that because this. And so I just kind of collected all the things I'd heard over the years and some of the reasons I'd come up with myself, you know, to be like, oh, I can't ride today, it's raining. It's like,
right?
Come on. You
that's
know?
The one I'm reading right now. Yeah, right.
You know, I live in Denver. If it rains, you know, it's not even a big deal. And you're like, people are riding all year in Portland and Seattle, and you're just sitting here making an excuse. And so I think that's why it succeeded. But still, every time it gets shared, people comment on, oh, this guy is an idiot, he doesn't know what my life is. And they make comments about why they definitely couldn't ride their bike to work. You know, like, well, try taking 3 kids to school and then driving 40 miles into the city to, I'm like, okay, yeah, definitely. That's definitely difficult. You probably can't pull that one off. So that was fun. And that one's really old. I want to say that's 5.5 years old. And it pops up every once in a while on the internet again. So yeah, that's a good one. I buy bike pretty much for all my transportation in the city. Here, I live pretty close to central Denver, pretty much downtown. So I don't have a lot of destinations that I don't need to really use a car for unless I'm picking up a bunch of packages or going to Home Depot or something like that. So it's been my way of getting around, which is really enjoyable.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brendan Leonard. He is the author of Semi-Rad. He's also a relatively new, I guess, columnist is the right word, for Outside Magazine. That's how I found out about you, talking to Axie Navis. And I've already spoken with Eben Weiss several times, so Bike Snob was not on the radar this time, but you are. All right, my next favorite one of yours, it's hilarious, is your flow chart. You know, about Pooping in the Outdoors, a flow chart by Brendan. And this comes, it's all the way back in May of 2013, but I'm sure it's pretty relevant even today, yes?
So yeah, I REI actually bought that idea from me and is putting that flowchart in their restrooms of their stores. So
that's a great one.
I've seen it myself in the DC store, Washington DC store, and I think it's in a few other ones at this point. But they hired a graphic artist to like actually make it way prettier.
Oh, but I think it looks cool the way it is.
Oh, so I just sat down in a coffee shop. Actually, pretty sure I drew that in the Denver Bicycle Cafe here, a coffee shop about five blocks from my house. And it's like literally just had a sheet of, you know, printer paper and was like, this will be funny, you know? And
it is funny.
I go back and look at it. And I'm like, God, that's really terrible. Like the penmanship, like you can barely read it. And,
no, I can read the whole thing. Come on. And I don't have great eyes. Right. It starts out, are you a human? Obviously, yes or no. Yes.
Yeah.
Are you hiking or backpacking? There's a yes. And then there's a no. But if you say no, that are you a human? Then it goes, are you a dog? No. Are you a horse? No. Are you a cow? No. Are you a bear? Yes. Oh, awesome. Because we all know about what bears do in the woods, right?
Yeah, totally.
I got it. It's just really, really, really funny. So, you've also written several books already. Now, you're not an old man, but you have several books out there. And a bunch of articles published in all kinds of great publications. Now you're a regular at Outside. What else do you do as if this wasn't enough? What other kinds of things besides your work do you like?
I do a little bit of filmmaking as well. So I usually take on one or two film projects a year, either passion projects or like paid work. But short films like outdoor adventure stuff. That we submit to film festivals. So a number of the films I've done have shown at like the Banff Film Festival or the Banff Tour, mountain film, stuff like that. So that's a very inefficient way of making money for me. So, 'cause I'm really bad at it, but I love it. So it's a fun thing to be able to take a story that, you know, like you're a writer and you know, you're kind of limited to language and stuff and to put it on a screen and to actually shoot it and add music it's this very rich experience. And then be able to watch an audience of, you know, like 800 people see the film is pretty cool. Compared to like the feedback you get from writing, which is, right. You know, usually just internet comments or Amazon reviews or whatever. So yeah, I've kind of been just like trying to make money as a creative and like do whatever I can. And, you know, sometimes film is kind of keeps you fresh. If I was doing nothing but writing all the time, I think I'd be really burned out by now. Because it's not like it was 20 years ago where you're writing a 12,000 word feature and that's like your entire living. You know, like you're getting paid enough money to live off for a month or two. You know, it's like you have to hustle nowadays and you have to write a lot of words. So I'm kind of glad I have multiple things that I do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just recently got one of those little cameras. It's called a Wasp Cam. It's very interesting. Mm. Yeah, I can't really tell you how I got it because it's like a trade secret at this point, but yeah. You know how those things go. But at any rate, I'm going to use it at the Builders Ball in New England to talk with people. So this is going to be my first foray into video. So maybe I'll get back to you and say, all right, what did I do wrong?
I think it's so fun to just learn by doing too, you know,
there's and like, that.
There's so many easy ways to do, you know, you can shoot a movie on your phone and edit a movie on your phone now.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's totally crazy. But like my iPhone shoots 4K, which is unbelievable to take it out and be like, oh wow, this is incredible how expensive a 4K camera was like a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And now it's in your phone.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you have a bike, I'm sure. What kind of bike do you ride?
So I actually am down to one bike right
Ooh,
now.
Ooh, minimalist.
It's a custom steel, I call it Urban Assault bicycle, but it's a road bike. It's a touring bike, that was made for me by a friend. which I was shooting a movie. I made a film about this guy. He has a bike shop about 15 blocks from me. It's called Chocolate Spokes.
What a great name for a store.
Oh yeah. He sells high-end chocolate out of the shop as well. And,
you're in Colorado. Is that all he sells? Just kidding.
Yeah. No, it's,
I'm just messing with you.
Bikes and chocolate, and the neighborhood is Five Points, and it's traditionally been kind of this African American Latino neighborhood.
Nice.
So there's a double play on the words there, but I was, you know, going to him for bike tune-ups and stuff. And I had this old Raleigh Team USA 1988, that I'd ridden across America in 2010. And it was just, I bought it for $100 and thought this would be funny to ride this across the country. And, I kept repairing it and like fixing it. Finally, it was just, there was something went wrong with the frame where I just said, fine, you know what? It's time to put my money where my mouth is. I'm going to buy a custom bike from you, you know, because I want to support your business. And I was kind of like, oh, custom bikes, those are for rich people. They're probably not that much different than what I can buy off the shelf somewhere.
Oh, yes, they are.
Yeah, I know. Now I ride my bike and I'm like, okay, this thing is amazing. So I'm having a great time with it.
Good. Well, that's all we do. I mean, that was my previous life before podcasting and radio, custom bikes. That's mm-hmm. all we did. And it is amazing. And you have steel. I'm so proud of you. That is awesome.
I've never ridden anything yeah. but steel on the streets. Like, it's
cool.
Yeah, for sure. I've taken it on kind of bike packing, like gravel grinding.
Sure.
Dirt road trips and stuff like that.
You have fenders on it?
No, because it's pretty dry here.
Well, that's true.
But I do have a front rack and a back rack. So
okay. Yeah. We'll let you pass on that one.
Yeah, totally.
What kinds of things do you find most annoying? Because annoying things often trigger funny responses.
Oh, I think people who argue about politics on the internet, I think it's kind of annoying. You know, like
that would be 24/7, right?
I know. We're not getting anywhere. You know, like plant a garden or so, you know, just do something productive with your time. Like, when was the last time an internet comment about politics changed your mind? You know, like, yeah, that guy's right. You know, I just don't, I think it's beyond the level of we're not having a discussion ever. So I find that kind of annoying, but you know, everybody is just doing what they think is best at some point, but we're becoming a really unfriendly society in some ways.
Uncivilized, you know?
Yeah. It's just like, come on, guys. Like, we can do better than this.
What's the most serious thing to you? What is serious to you?
Oh, I take a lot of my work pretty seriously, I guess. It's a joke, but I always, you know, like a lot of it is humor, but I want it to be the best it can be. You know, like, I guess that's the thing I would say is most serious for me. That's the thing that keeps me up at night a lot. So.
Okay.
For the most part, everything is pretty contrived. You know, we're like beyond like survival. Nothing is really that serious when you take a broad step back and look at it. But yeah, no, I'm pretty focused on art, work, you know, that stuff. So
sure. Do you own a car?
Yeah, I do. I have an old Subaru wagon I bought off of my girlfriend's sister before she left for New Zealand last year. So it has 196,000 miles on it, and it's handy, but, yeah, and my mom actually suggested maybe you should get a little bit nicer car.
Because?
It broke down on the side of the road a few weeks ago, and I was like, nah, it's fine. That was a fluke, you know?
Right.
Yeah, come on, mom. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you told me that because I just got a Subaru Outback last fall.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, last December. I brought it home December 30th, and I love it. It is the best car I've ever had. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. I just wish everybody, I mean, like, I can't imagine not having all wheel drive in Colorado, just to go skiing and stuff. And in the winter, I looked around. I'm like, that'd be cool if somebody else made an affordable all wheel drive. Like, nah, that's fine. Just keep buying used Subarus for the rest of your life.
Yes. Right. Well, it had to be big enough to hold two dog crates. So that was deal. But I had to be able to schlep my dogs around.
Are they big dogs?
They're not that big. But when we travel on the road, I don't like them just like hanging out free in the back of the car. I like them safe and crated. They're each between 45 and 50 pounds, you know, somewhere.
Oh, nice.
I call them mid-sized, you know, like the car, mid-sized. All right. These are my three funny questions. What's your favorite food?
Oh, boy. Pizza, I guess. Yeah.
Oh.
I'd say pizza.
Oh. Well, actually, the truth is nobody has said pizza in a while, so I'm going to let that one pass.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm getting to the point where I'm like feeling like I'm almost a connoisseur at this point.
So. Of pizza?
Yeah.
Have you been to Bijou's little curry shop?
Yeah, totally. It's great.
He's a cool guy.
Yeah.
What kind of music do you like?
I like a lot of stuff, but mostly I'm like old school hip hop from like 1980 to 1999, maybe. Sort of 20-year period in there that I've actually like studied a lot, I guess. I read about a lot. So that's my music, I guess.
Any pets? Do you have any pets?
No, I think we'll end up with a golden retriever in my girlfriend and I at some point in the near future. But we're just kind of circling the drain on it. I feel like it's, you know.
Trying to make a choice. Should we? Shouldn't we? Well, they do tie you down some. I can tell you, for travel, you either have to have a sitter or take them with you. You know, because I won't kennel them. You know, it's just like not a good idea, I don't think.
Yeah, I feel like that, unless you have something really, that you can really trust somebody with, it's right. Like, you know, if the dog likes it. But yeah, that's tough.
So I don't usually ask this question, but it occurred to me that you would be a good person to ask. What's on your nightstand? What are you reading right now?
You know, I read this, it's in a Medium article. I need to actually try to corroborate this, but this guy claimed that 90% of books purchased on Amazon were given as gifts. And I have about 14 books sitting on my nightstand, and I think 11 of them were given to me.
So he might be right?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm currently working through, The Savage Detectives by Roberto Bolaño, and, there's another one, Alistair Humphreys, if you've ever heard of him.
Mm-mm.
He's a British adventurer. Who
sounds like a British guy.
Yeah, he bicycled around the world.
Wait a minute. Maybe I did
10 years ago. But he gave me a book by Laurie Lee called As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning, which is it's an older book, but it's a guy who inspired Alistair to just leave his house with, I think it was a violin. And trek around Europe with no money and just busk for money. But Al doesn't know how to play the violin, so it was comical. So he almost starved, but that was one of his most recent adventures. So. But yeah, those are the top two that I'm working on right now.
Well, this has been a delightful conversation. Why don't you let our listeners know how they can read more about your work? What is the website? And give us the title of a couple of your books.
Oh, yeah. So the website is semirad.com, semi-rad. If you just Google semirad, it should come up. And that's also my Instagram and Twitter handles. And my current book that's out is called The Great Outdoors, A User's Guide, which is this kind of all-encompassing guide to everything in the outdoors, from canoeing to ice climbing, you know, how to fix a flat tire on your bicycle, you know, how to mountain bike. And that came out in April. And then I have an outdoors cookbook coming out with a friend who I co-authored it with. And that's called Best Served Wild. And that's with my friend Anna Bronis.
I know Anna Bronis.
Oh, you do? Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm sure you do. She's in cycling circles, and she's written a couple bicycling books. So.
She has indeed. Well, Brendan, thank you so much. Have fun with Outside Magazine and duke it out with Eben. You know, we'll see, you know, how the columns sort of line up or not. He has such an interesting, snarky view on the world.
Oh, yeah. So, it's totally different. Totally
it is.
Different. So,
it is.
Yeah.
It is. Well, thanks so much. Have a wonderful afternoon. Thanks for talking with me. And we'll talk again sometime.
Right on. Thanks for having me, Diane.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Brendan Leonard joined me from his home in Colorado, a golden retriever puppy. I think that would be a good addition to their family. I hope you enjoyed that interview. We need to take a break, and we'll be back to talk with Rob Myers about the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces and the ride that they produce and what happens in the Middle East during that ride. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM. WJCU University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and sitting across from me is Rob Myers. Hi, Rob. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me in the studio this week.
Diane, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah? When was the last time you were in a radio station? Because I know you did some of this stuff in college.
Well, it's been a while since I was actually in a radio station, although I've been to TV stations and such with Fred back in years past.
For those who do not know about whom we're speaking, Fred Griffith is a TV personality here in Cleveland. He was, and he is Rob's father-in-law, right?
Stepfather.
We're not really here to talk about that. You and I met, was it about 9 years ago? I was trying to think.
I think it is probably about 9 or 10 years ago, yeah.
And you came into our shop and decided we probably couldn't make a better bike than the one you were riding. I remember you saying that at some point.
Well, I was pretty happy with the bike until you guys saw me. You put me on the stand and watched me ride. And I just remember you shaking your head going, we have to change this.
Did we?
You changed it, and you changed my whole cycling world.
And today you're a pretty accomplished cyclist.
I'm riding a lot more than I was when we first met, and it's mostly thanks to you and Brian, actually.
Well, thanks. We like to hear that. And if you don't mind telling the listeners, how old are you?
I am 55 years old.
Wow. How'd you get to be so old?
You know, that's what happens.
I remember when your kids were still in, like, middle school and high school, and now they're, like, almost all out of college.
Yep. I've got one more still with 2 years left. The other two are graduated, and one's self-sufficient, I'm happy to say.
No kidding. I want to talk about a couple of things. The most important is your experience in the Middle East, but Brian told me this, and I didn't know this. You've won the Belfair Biathlon the last 2 years in a row?
The last 3 years, actually.
Oh.
It's a relay, and I have a friend, Brad Sanders, who does the run part, and I do the time trial part on the bike. And yes, Brad and I have collaborated and won the last 3 years.
That's pretty cool. So here's a little tidbit you may not know. I was the race director for the very first JCB Biathlon.
Well, see, that's karma.
Yeah, but that's a long time ago. It's been going on a long time. I'm glad to hear that it still is.
They get a lot of participation in that race. It's pretty fun.
Yes, they do. Is it growing still? Is it still a big event?
It's big enough. I mean, they had, I think, 140 relay teams, and then they have some people that are doing the individual race, and they have, I think, about 100 of them. So it's a pretty well-attended event.
The course is beautiful, though, for those who are familiar with the Northeast Ohio area. It goes through sort of Beechwood and down to Gates Mills Boulevard and around and back.
It's a nice time trial course.
It's very pretty. And I think that you actually get the police in all the communities to stop traffic.
They do a beautiful, awesome job. I thank them from here. I thank them on the day of the event. But yes, they close the intersections for us and they take great care of us.
Which is really saying a lot, given that you have to go through, if I'm not mistaken, it's Cleveland Heights, Shaker Heights, Beechwood, and Pepper Pike?
Yes.
Yeah, you go through all four.
All
right.
Four.
Right.
Yep.
All right, let's move on to what we're going to talk about, which is some of the iconic rides you've done. I'm particularly interested in the ride you did for the FIDF, which is the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces in Israel. I think it was in 2015, right?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit of your knowledge about that organization, because it was because of you and a conversation you and I had that I looked into this organization and was extremely impressed.
So the Friends of the IDF is an organization that's put together. It's a charitable organization whose mission is to try to help supply IDF soldiers with things that the IDF can't supply. There's a number of different programs they have, but for example, they have a STRIDES program, which supplies sports prosthetics to wounded veterans from the IDF. We rode with some of those guys on that ride. Most of them had lost a leg. One guy had lost an arm, but they supply sports prosthetics that come from the United States. It's funded by the FIDF. There's another phenomenon that people really don't know, but in the Israeli Defense Forces, there's a program called Lone Soldiers. This is kids that are 18 to 22 that are from other countries that feel the desire to help defend Israel. And they go to Israel and they serve alongside native Israelis. But they don't have the supports that the natives have. They don't have families there. So on weekends where they can go home, they don't have a home there to go to. So the FIDF provides hostels and places for them to go on holidays, gift baskets and things that the other guys and girls are getting from their families. The FIDF supplies them. So it's a support thing. And then the other part of the FIDF is to try to supply things that, quite frankly, the IDF doesn't have the funds for. So, for example, on one of the Air Force bases, they supplied an apartment, I think is a two-bedroom apartment, for off-duty officers that the IDF simply didn't have the money for. Israel is not a rich country, believe it or not. I was really surprised at learning really where their emphasis is. Their emphasis is on actually defending their country right around the corner from their bases. So anything extraneous, they're not paying any money for. And so the FIDF helps plug that gap for them.
Well, I want to explore a little bit about the ride that you did. And then I want to go back to some of the things that people may or may not know about what's going on in the Middle East, which I think is pertinent because you got to ride through most of the countryside. Tell us a little bit about that ride. Now, it changes every year.
This year they have a different course. The year I went was the first year they've done it. So they had a pretty steep learning curve. On that ride, we went from the very far north, the northernmost part of Israel, which was about less than 100 yards off the Lebanese border, all the way down to the Red Sea in Eilat. And we rode nearly the whole way. We rode about 450 miles and did about 32,000 feet of climbing in that ride. We were in a different place every night, which I think they found to be a little challenging for the people that were on that ride. It was okay for me, but I could see where other people found that to be a little bit too big of a challenge.
Why is that?
Well, when you're doing a ride like that every day, you're just the physical aspect of changing your clothes, getting things to dry, having a couple of changes of cycling shorts, being able to lay it out, not have to pack it again. For me, that would make a lot of sense. I think for some of the other people, just the hassle packing every morning before leaving, I think that got to be a little wearing for some of the people. But they don't do that now. Now they set up at a couple of hotels. They have better accommodations than we had. We stayed at some kibbutzes that were not what I would call three-star whatever. I mean, they were fine and clean and everybody was friendly and they were super places to learn about. And I'm glad that I had that experience. But for Americans, they were a little on the rugged side. So they've changed the accommodations. Also, the tour operator that went with us had some things to learn about running a cycling tour. Now they're working with a much more accomplished tour operator. So my understanding is that things are much more coordinated. I found everything to be fine. So when they say more coordinated, that's great. But I didn't have any issues with what they did, you know, 2 years ago. So for me, they could do that every year, and that would be a good thing. So
what were your average mileages per day? So if somebody's exhausted at the end of the day because it was such a long day. And I also want to know a little bit about the temperature and the weather in Israel at the time you go. So this is an October ride?
Right. This is in October. So in the so Israel, even though it's a tiny country, to give you a calibration, if you were to take Ohio and slice it into five vertical slices, one slice is about Israel.
Wow.
So it's at its widest, it's not much more than 40 or 50 miles. That's under current scenarios.
Yeah, right.
From north to south, it's about like from Toledo to Dayton in terms of the length of the country. But the different climates are amazing. In the far north in October, we had cool rain, 50s in rain. In the far south, you're in the Negev Desert. And in Eilat, you're in a desert climate right on the Red Sea. And everybody's, you know, average temperature, I don't know what the average is, but when we were there, it was about 80 degrees or 85. And getting in the water was a good thing.
I'd like to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Rob Myers. He is actually a personal friend, so I have to fess up to that. And we're talking about his ride 2 years ago in Israel with the FIDF, Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces. And this year, it looks like the ride is shorter than the one you did, 350 miles, ascending 22,000 feet. So the temperature would change depending on the terrain, I imagine?
Sure. So again, by way of calibrating, so in the far north, they have a mountain, Mount Hermon, Mount Hermon is the equal of any of the climbs that they do during any of the grand tours. It's 5,800 feet up over about 28 kilometers. It took me 2.5 hours to get up there. It's not setting any records or anything, but that was a pretty, that's the first time I've ever done anything like that. In the south, you're going through desert terrain, and it's totally different. They actually have a ski area, believe it or not, on the top of the Hermon. Not at the top. At the very top is an observation post that the Israelis took after the 72 war. But just below that, they have a ski area, and periodically during the winter, they have snow, and they go skiing there.
So they don't actually make snow. They wait for it.
They wait for it,
right?
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the people of Israel. Not all Israelis are Jews.
No.
At all, and people may or may not understand that.
No, our bus driver was Arab.
Okay. And so what is happening in the country? Were you afraid? I know people carry weapons everywhere they go.
It's a little unnerving as an American because first of all, everybody that's 18 has to join the IDF. They all have to serve. It's compulsory. Israel, being as tiny as it is, there's about 14 million people there, I think. 6 million are Jews. It's something like that, 11 million or something. Whatever it is, it's tiny. It's surrounded by 600 million people in Arab countries that range from moderately enemies to rabid enemies. And so service there is compulsory. So also, if you are in the IDF, you must carry your weapon at all times. That's a rule. So you can be off duty and you can go to the falafel stand and you're strapped with an automatic rifle or grenade launcher over your back and they're everywhere. And the kids, you know, they're 18, 19-year-old kids strapped with automatic weapons. As an American, that's something we're not used to seeing. That's their reality.
Yeah, in Chicago maybe. that's a different story. I'm sorry, Chicago, I didn't mean to beat you up. I guess then becomes the question, what is violence like in Israel, inside the country?
There is none. Very, very minimal. You read about, of course, in the news, you read about all of the things that are newsworthy, which is all the violent things that happen. But inside the country, it's very, very minimal. There's not, I at no time felt like I was unsafe. Now, having said that, our Arab bus driver was carrying a sidearm, as were two of our guides. They were all carrying sidearms. But outside of that, I mean, there was no point at which I have to say I felt more unsafe actually just being a cyclist on the roads with trucks, you know, triple bed.
Oh, like when they put the different trailers together?
Yeah, they put three trailers together and they carry like borax or something that they're mining down in one of the areas and they're driving down the freeway and they go past you. That's a little more unnerving than anything else. The only time that I heard any gunfire was actually the climb up the Hermon. I could hear gunfire. And when we got to the top, we got a tour of the base at the top, at the very top. And I asked one of the soldiers if that was them doing target practice. And he said, no, that's the rebellion in Syria, because I had no idea that I was that close to the border that we could hear the artillery on the way up the Hermon, which was a little unnerving. But as they explained to me from the top of the Hermon, this is what people don't understand in the United States. Israel is tiny. The Middle East is nothing like you imagine. From the top of the Hermon in Israel, it is less than a maybe a 2.5 hour bike ride for me to ride to Beirut if I could do that.
Holy smokes.
Right? It's about a 3 or 3.5 hour ride from the Hermon to Damascus. It's nothing. It's like 60 miles.
Wow.
Which we don't really understand in this country. And so when people talk to me about land for peace and this and that in the area, in the United States, we really don't understand the terrain there and how significant the terrain is to whatever the peace agreement, if they ever reach one, really is, or how critical it is to Israel that they control certain areas because of the landforms. In the United States, we don't even think about it. We think about our southern border being this long thing and it's all open and all that. But the southern border for us is a 6-hour plane ride. In Israel, their southern border is a one long day ride, maybe a day and a half from Jerusalem, on a bicycle.
Right.
It's not very far. And the width of the country is not even, you know, it's a 2-hour bike ride, 3 hours maybe because of the terrain. It's not much of a distance. And it's something that really the people that think about this and opine on it, they really need to have an understanding that I was standing in Israel and I could have ridden my bicycle, forgetting the political situation and everything. I could have physically ridden my bicycle to any of those capitals in under 3 hours.
So what keeps Israel from being blown up?
Well, the IDF.
Okay. So we're back to the organization.
The IDF is what keeps Israel from being blown up. If the Israelis put down their arms, they would be gone. The IDF in the north, they patrol the Golan. And, you know, we have deer crossing signs and pedestrian crossing signs.
Right.
Riding from the Golan south to the Galilee, we saw tank crossing signs, and there's fresh tracks across the road where tanks that are on active maneuvers just were crossing right before we got there. And it's a real thing there. Israel is really, to think of Israel, you have to think of it in terms of it being a castle surrounded by enemies. And the IDF is its defender and its moat. And as you get further south in the country, you hear F-18s and now F-35s. You hear them all day long on maneuvers. You can't see them. They're up too high. You don't see them. And the sound travels so differently than light. Then you're looking where the sound's from. You can't see where the plane is. But they're up there all day long, every day, 24/7, patrolling north, south, east, west.
I have kind of a different question. If we could take the planes out of the air and there was no fighting there, what is the country like? What is at surrounding countries? It's still part of the Middle East. And yet, it's sort of like an oasis is the way I think of it.
Yeah. So the very first reaction I had to Israel was it smelled like cow shit. We were staying, the first kibbutz we stayed at was near a dairy farm, and the whole country smells like cow shit. And the reason for that is everything is rock and sand. So wherever they're growing anything, they've had to make their own soil. So they use the manure and they amend the soil to be able to grow things. And they have the Israelis invented drip irrigation because they have to husband their water carefully, but they have to spread it and they have to spread the manure. And this is what they do. And there is no cant in Israel. The people are not like that. If they have an obstacle, they're going to figure a way around it. That's what they do. That's why this tiny little country has a nickname called Startup Nation. It's because they create things that the rest of the world finds useful, and they create them out of necessity. They have no choice. They can't depend on anybody else for anything. And so that's what they do.
Just to add a little bit to this, as background on Rob, your background is geology.
Yeah, yeah. And Israel geologically is an amazingly interesting place. The Jordan River and the Red Sea are actually on top of a continental rift. So if people remember their high school science class, physical science class. They talk about rifts and that America and Europe and Africa and South America once fit together and split apart. That process is happening right now under the Jordan River. That's a rift. And one of the things that does is it lowers where the rift is so that the continental crust drops as it's ripping open. That's why the Dead Sea is so low. But the highlands are pushed up on either side of the rift as this spreads. And so as it spreads open, it shoves the crust up into these fingerling arches. And as it shoves the crust up, the arches at the top break, and erosion takes all the break stuff out. And you're left with these long lenticular craters. And in Israel, that's a landform found only in Israel called a muktesh. And you climb up one side, you drop down into the muktesh, you go across the bottom of the muktesh, and you know you have to climb up out the other side.
And how deep are they?
They vary. The largest one, I think, was around 1,000 feet deep or something like that. So they're a fairly significant landform, and to get up, they're switchbacks. So it's a nice little climb to get up out of there.
So what would you do with this formation once it's formationed? What can you do with it? I mean, it's just there?
Yeah, it's just there.
They can't grow anything on it. They can't.
You know. Well, the mukteshes are in a part of the country where they're not growing much, but there is mining there. There are minerals in some in the bottoms of some of these mukteshes that they do mine commercially. So that's what they do.
Let's talk about food. Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Rob Myers. We're talking about Israel. We're going to talk about the food on the ride that he did in 2015. The ride will again take place, the FIDF, Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces, October 20th through 26th of this year. It is going from Eilat to Jerusalem. So how was the food on the ride?
The food was food.
I'm hearing like, oh, wait, it's like England.
Lots of buffets with schnitzel.
No kidding.
Yeah. Schnitzel, rice, things like that. That's mostly what we had. Now, we were staying, at that time, we stayed on kibbutzes, and they had buffets set up for us. Some were better than others. Some of the areas were much more plush. Some of the kibbutzes were very utilitarian. But, you know, the food was fuel. And you're talking to somebody that doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about food other than just as fuel. So for me, it was fine. If you're into fine dining and things like that, that trip might have been a little on the rough side.
Yeah, this one sounds like it's going to be better. First and second nights will be spent at the Queen of Sheba Eilat Hotel. It is on a prime position on the seafront. And so that is my father, when he was there, loved Haifa.
Now, Haifa is on the Mediterranean.
That's what he liked.
And, yeah, Eilat's on the Red Sea.
Did you float in the Dead Sea?
No, you know, we didn't. We had a problem getting there. There was a, we got to the Dead Sea, but we got there really, really late.
It didn't go away.
No, but we weren't there long enough for us to take a day and go and do that. We weren't really on a tourist trip. We were there on our bikes, and we had a plan and an itinerary that we had to keep up with. So, unfortunately, no, we didn't get to do that. That was the one part of Israel we were not permitted to cycle through, was the section controlled by the Palestinian Authority. We could not cycle through there. We had to go all the way around that.
Added some mileage?
They actually put us on a bus, and we were going to bus through it, and then we got most of the way towards the Dead Sea, and then there was a flood. October is their rainy season.
I was just going to say, a flood in Israel sounds like an oxymoron, but okay.
Yeah, the road was flooded, and we had to go all the way around through Jerusalem.
Wow. What did you think of the old city of Jerusalem?
Never saw it.
Oh, you didn't?
We went through it at night. Not, you know what? I would say that the reason to go is so you have a reason to go back to see the things you didn't see. We got to climb Mount Gilboa, for example. Mount Gilboa, from there, you look down across the valley, and you can see the valley where David fought Goliath. I mean, you really can't make this stuff up.
Right.
Down in the valley, there's an old Byzantine and Roman city called Beit Shan. Beit Shan was a thriving spot on the Silk Road and Spice Road. And I want to say like in 700 AD or something, there was an earthquake, and these huge Byzantine columns toppled over, and nobody figured out how to stand them back up again. So they're laying right where they fell still to this day. And they've got amphitheater, and they've got the thing that I found most interesting was they had a group bathroom that had the marble seats that the Romans used to, you know, and the whole plumbing system's still there. So,
wow.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah. One trip to Israel, you're not going to see everything. And whether you're Jewish or not Jewish, it's an amazing confluence of geology and history and innovation. The people are by far and away so nice and interested in what you are, where you're from. They all have an attitude that they're going to defend their country. So there's always that, but there's not a single one, even the active duty colonel that we met, that wouldn't lay down their arms in a heartbeat if the circumstances permitted.
Really?
Yeah. They talk about wanting to do that. But, you know, to give you an example, that colonel that we spoke about has lost part of his leg, was one of the wounded soldiers we rode with. He's on a prosthetic provided by the FIDF, and he had an active bodyguard crew with him the whole time because he's a high value person to be kidnapped.
Oh, great.
And well, that's again, it's reality. Israel's a castle. His mission is to monitor the tunnels that Hamas is digging under their southern border with Gaza. And they can hear him digging them. And they know they're building them. They know where they are. They have them mapped. He's just watching them. We ask them, why don't they stop them? And he says, when the politicians tell me to act, then I'll act. Until then, we monitor. And whatever they tell me to do, I will do.
I don't want to have a political discussion, but I know we could.
It's a tough political situation there. There's a lot of people here in the United States that really, it's easy to sit back and it's easy to opine on what somebody should or shouldn't do. But until you really understand that the land that people in of that persuasion are insisting that Israel give up would mean that the middle of Israel would only be about 15 miles wide. Now, that's not defensible. Not only is it narrow, but all of the land they're being asked to think about giving up is called the Judean Highlands. It's highland for a reason. Even the crappy rockets that the Gazans have that they shoot over that don't hit anything sometimes, those rockets would have a commanding presence over Tel Aviv, Haifa, as you mentioned, the Ben-Gurion Airport, their seaports, everything would be under that rocket fire. And realistically, they just can't give that up. And they can't create another situation where they have a constant stream of rockets coming at the highly populated areas of their country. So it's a very ticklish situation. I don't know what the solution would be.
Yeah, I wish somebody would come up with a solution.
There is one, but it's politically untenable today. But there is a solution, but I don't know how you'd
get everybody to agree.
You'd need the political world to have a different attitude internationally about what the solution might be, and then you could create a solution there. Yeah.
You and I will talk separately.
Yeah, we can talk off. This is about cycling, which is a lot more fun.
It is a lot more fun. Well, yes and no. You are always an interesting person to have a conversation with. You brought your own bike when you went on this ride.
I did. Bikes are inanimate objects, but the bike you and Brian built for me is somewhat animated.
Yes, by the way, we call it the Parrot Bike.
Parrot Bike, yeah. There was no way that I could take a trip like that and do an adventure like that and leave that bike at home.
It needed to go to Israel with
you. It needed to go with me, and I'm really, really happy that I had it with me. It made the trip that much better that I wasn't worried about the equipment or on borrowed equipment. My fit was dialed in. I bought a bike bag from SkyCon where all you really have to do is take the wheels off and it packs right up in about a minute. And you can pack it, it's safe for the bike, and unpack it and put your bike back together and be ready to go in about a minute.
Obviously, they move your equipment from day to day, not the bike. You're riding the bike, but they're moving your clothes and they're moving
right.
your stuff from
you
day to day.
You have to pack up. And when I did it, now my understanding is this year they're not moving every day. They're staying put for a few days at a time. And then
they are. It looks like they're going to be in four different hotels. How was the language? Did you have a language? Everybody speaks English, huh? You don't speak Hebrew.
I don't speak any Hebrew, unfortunately.
Yeah, me too.
Or whatever.
Right.
But everybody spoke English that we were around. Most everybody around that country speaks English in one way or another, even the taxi drivers. When I got to the airport and I needed to go from the airport to the hotel and I had this giant bike bag and we needed to figure out how to get it into a taxi, we were able to
have a conversation.
But it's an amazing thing, Diane. We grow up in the United States as a minority, and you're always a minority, and it's a really weird feeling when you get off the plane and you're going to the taxi and everybody's Jewish. It's a very different feeling.
That would be very strange, yeah.
It's a different feeling. You go to the bar, and there was – I've got a picture that I took of a bottle of tequila, and it's in Hebrew, tequila, on the bottle, and you're just – it's just a whole different – it's just a different feeling. It's a very bizarre and almost a welcoming feeling.
Well, I remember when my dad went, and he was a changed person. He was not a religious person per se. He did not openly practice being Jewish, but he was a changed man.
I'm not practicing. I don't consider myself religious, but I do identify as a Jewish person. I do identify with the culture. I identify mostly with the people and the situation that they're in as an underdog. I identify with that quite a bit. And I also understand from historical perspective, if Israel doesn't exist, then the chances of a problem like we had in the 40s coming back is much, much higher, and especially today where you hear some people talk, and it's just amazing to me that in a lot of areas, even in the United States on college campuses, there's a lot of anti-Semitism back, and it's open and it's not hidden. There's a lot of people that will tell you to your face about things like that. And it's mind-blowing to me that 70 years later, we're back fighting that fight again.
Yeah, it seems like it goes around, comes around way too often. So what is your next cycling adventure? You are not heading back to Israel this year.
It's not my plan.
But it could happen.
Well, it could. Anything could happen. Right now, it's not my plan. I don't have a hard plan yet where I've committed the time on my calendar or schedule or money, but I'm thinking very hard about a trip into Spain this year to go with a group that does a little bit harder rides. The one thing about the FIDF cycling trip is the range of rider is very, very wide. So I would not be concerned if you're a person that rides 20 miles and that's all you can do. They will accommodate you. There are plenty of people like that on the trip. If you can't get up the first riding day this year, they're going from Eilat up out of Eilat. Well, in order to get out of Eilat, you have to climb the Eilat mountains. That's not all short trip up, you know, Chagrin River Road or anything like that. That's a pretty major climb. And that's not an easy day. And if you don't feel up to it, no problem. They will accommodate you. They'll help you get to the next spot. They have a bus, follow bus, not a problem. So I would not let the bike be an impediment. But that said, for people that are much more serious about the biking part of it than the Israel part, that may be more of an issue where you might want to, you know, find something that's a little bit more challenging for yourself. When we went, it was plenty challenging. I had a great time. They allowed me to go at whatever pace I wanted to go. And you and Brian know I like to go hard. That's what I did. And the last day was 100 and some miles through the Negev Desert. And that was a blast. Flying through the desert, I was all by myself. And just the wind and me and a couple cars going by me. One guy on a Ducati motorcycle.
Nice.
And going as hard as I wanted to go. And just flat out all day long through the desert, about 5 hours. And that was fun.
Well, as I remember, you also ride a motorcycle.
I do, and a Ducati. That's why I got to get my shout out to my my Ducati brothers.
I thought you had a BMW.
No. Italian baby.
Oh, yeah, right. Italian baby. That is correct. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. I appreciate you taking time off of your busy day to come into the studio and talk with me.
Well, the only thing I would say to any of your listeners, if you like to ride a bike and you've ever, ever thought you'd like to see that part of the world, this is an awesome way to see it. Most of the people that are organized this are people that either lived in Israel or live in Israel now or are in Israel a lot. They know what to see, where to go. They also, part of the trip, because it's with the FIDF, we get to see where the IDF is. And we go to some of their bases.
Oh, you did? You did?
Oh, we went to the forward observation post on the top of the Hermon. We also went onto the Lebanese border to the forward observation post where you're standing there and just at the bottom of the hill, there's a fence. And on the other side of the fence is Hezbollah. I mean, you're right there. It is unnerving at one time to think about. On the other hand, you really get a good appreciation of these people that are just like us. They're these kids, 19-year-old kids, they're just like my daughters and my son. They're just our kids defending their country against all odds. It's really an amazing thing to see. And visiting their bases, you see how they're living and so on. The Air Force people live way better than the infantry. I will just say that.
So if you're going to Israel and decide to sign up, you want to be in the Air Force?
You want to be in the Air Force right. Or the Navy. The infantry's got Spartan digs for sure. But
well, if anyone is interested in the FIDF ride this year, you can go to FIDF.org. The ride, again, is October 20th through the 26th. And there is a fundraising arm of the ride, yes?
No, just the money that you're spending for the ride. There is no fundraising during the ride. There's no ask. They just want you to be there and experience Israel, to meet people from the IDF. They're looking to do what they did to me. They're looking to teach us about the realities there so that we're not guessing and we're not making opinions about things that we don't know anything about. They're trying to expand, obviously, the number of people that would contribute to the FIDF ultimately, and I have since. But that's not the object. The object is cycling, learning about the country, seeing it in a way that you never would get to see in any other way. If you're riding your bike and you're just going on an average basis and you're going 15 miles an hour, you're going to see that country in a totally different way than if you're on a tour bus with 35 people and somebody talking at you through a microphone. And I wholeheartedly endorse it and suggest that anybody that's ever thought about it, it's perfectly safe. Other than the road, the people drive crazy, but that's the same everywhere.
I was just going to say, why is that different than here?
No, it's no different than here. It's unbelievable landforms, unbelievable things to see. The history is, there is no other place that's been more historically important in the world other than maybe Rome. And it really is something to see. And talking to the people there, you really get a good understanding of things. So.
Well, thanks, Rob. Have a wonderful rest of your day. And I appreciate, again, that you came in and shared your experience with us.
Great talking to you, Diane.
Bye-bye. Wow, what an interesting conversation. Rob is always full of insight and information and ideas, and I always appreciate that he's willing to share them with me. That's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. I want to thank Brendan Leonard for also taking time to talk with me. We will be back next week with a brand new show. I hope if you have a chance, you'll go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.